Can you tell me about your early life growing up and something about yourself before the movement here?
Okay, I was born in 1938 in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I was just an ordinary little white guy in Albuquerque. I don't know how detailed you want me to get. I graduated from high school in 1957. Pretty unremarkable. I was a little overweight, kid, a little white guy. I don't know where to go with that. How much you want me to do?
Well, anything that I guess since we're talking today, since you're talking about the civil rights movement, if there are any incidents in your early life that you can think of that may have pointed you towards that.
Well, I was at one point a real serious Christian, Episcopalian. I took literally what everybody said about justice and freedom and human rights and equality and all that stuff. And then when I started trying to put it in practice as a kid, I got put down for it. So I realized there was a lot of hypocrisy in the institutions where I was living. So I'm sure that had a, I know that had a big effect on me, and I was pretty disgusted. I went in the military in 1957, right out of high school, and I met the first black people I've ever known in my life, first Indian people, and I'm from New Mexico where there's a lot of Indian people, but it was at that time it was pretty segregated. I discovered a world out there, beyond Albuquerque and New Mexico. And I discovered other cultures. And I befriended, had some pretty tight friendships in the Navy with Comanche Indians from Oklahoma and African Americans from New York City. And it had a big effect on me. And a real big effect, because I started snapping to racism and discrimination and issues like that. And they befriended me because I treated them with respect, and we got in a few altercations together, and we were fought back to back.
What kind of altercations?
Against racist Navy personnel and in California and elsewhere. We went overseas together and we came back. I came out of the Navy and I was I went to my church and I resigned. I said, don't call me, I'll call you.
The church?
Yeah, I didn't want anything to do with it anymore. Well, I didn't tell you about this, but as a kid, I was incested by some of the clergy, and when I was just preteen.
So this was, I can't remember if you meant this really.
I didn't know about that till later, because my mind wouldn't let me hear it.
What denomination was the?
Episcopalian.
Oh, okay, Episcopalian. Okay.
Yeah, real upper class kind of church.
Okay. So you had, when you came back out of the Navy, you went back, one of the first things you did was you went to the church and you said.
Yeah, I resigned from the church. Yeah. I started going to school at UNM, University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. And I went there on and off, and I got very involved right away in all kinds of political stuff. Norman Thomas came, we brought him, and he stayed at my house and spent all night in heavy-duty philosophical discussion about socialism. And, I was looking for stuff. I was looking for things. I was looking for some answers.
So this would have been the late 1950s, I guess. Navy, but
59-62.
Okay. When you were in the Navy, and this is
go ahead.
You mentioned earlier that it was really important for you to have these relationships with Native Americans, African Americans, and it was the first time. At the same time, did you start seeing things happening around you, like say in the press, for example? Did that have an impact on you?
No, not so much, because we didn't have much access to the press. I'll tell you what did have a big impact on me. It was because of my religious beliefs. It just happens when it happens, I guess. I was walking down a hangar bay. I remember the day. I remember we were in a hangar bay of an aircraft carrier. It's the bay where all the planes are held underneath the flight deck. And I remember stopping, stunned with the thought of how can the hell can you have a chaplain in the military? Just a simple question. But you know, the question who took, you know, I took this all these rules and values of the Christian church literally. And when I started thinking for myself, excuse me. That's what happened as I started thinking for myself.
The contradiction between this military hardware and the religion which teaches.
Yeah, and then, right. And I was, you know, when I was in the military, I thought, damn, you know, because they put me on a landing party off the coast of Formosa. We were going to occupy the Kimoimatsu Islands off the coast of Formosa against the Chinese. I was pretty ignorant about the world. I was very ignorant about the world, but I was saying, now wait a minute. If I'm going to shoot somebody, and I never had to call, you know, call into question, but I said, who am I shooting and why? I started talking to Carl Adovich, the Apache Indian, and Tony Gray, who was an African-American from New York. So, you know, and I felt safe talking to them about it. And they talked, and they treated me with respect and took me seriously. No, and I felt safe talking to them. I didn't feel safe talking to any of the, almost none of the white guys. And I don't know why. I just intuitively knew that there was something wrong there, that it was safe to talk to them but not the others, because they would understand or they would respect my thoughts.
Your thoughts, yeah.
And they did.
So, Ian, now you're at the University of New Mexico.
We started doing all kinds of stuff. My dad had apartment houses that were segregated in Albuquerque. I tried to desegregate them. We organized a freedom ride through southeastern New Mexico, which is we call Little Texas.
Now, when you say we, who was we?
People I started associating with.
Okay.
A little socialist student organization. We started it was, you know, 10 people. But
on campus, maybe.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And started, you know, we found out that the motels and restaurants in southeastern New Mexico were segregated. I mean, they had signs of like no niggers or dogs, and you know, pretty blatant shit. So, is it all right if I say shit?
Oh yeah, it's fine.
All right. Anyway, and we organized a freedom ride. I went to the local sporting goods store, and owned by three Jewish men, and I told them what I wanted to do, and they said right on, and they gave me the tape recording, and we wired ourselves with mics down our sleeves and stuff, and black and white men and women, we got in my car, and we did a freedom ride through southeastern New Mexico trying to get accommodations and recording their responses. And then we took the tapes and played them for the state legislature, and they passed the first public accommodations laws in the country against discrimination in public places. I'm real proud of that. As stupid and, you know, ignorant and naive as we were, we did do something.
Wow, that's really something. So that, do you remember what year was that, in 59 or?
61, I think
61,
it was.
Okay.
Yeah, 60, 61, right in there.
So this was really around the same time, or maybe a little before the freedom, well, before the...
Yeah, it was before the World War sit-ins.
Okay, so it was, and then it was before the freedom ride in the South.
We had our own freedom ride. I don't even know. As far as I can remember, we didn't, you know, I didn't concoct any, you know, I didn't get an idea from, I don't know where I got it.
These were local from the...
Oh, yeah.
Your group.
Yeah. We said, let's go take care of the business.
Okay.
And it was scary, man. They, you know, we got real close to getting in some very tight cracks. I mean, I don't want to go into the, you know, but we ran into some heavy-duty racism and organized racist violence. You know, they didn't get us, but they tried.
Some of the business owners must have been pretty angry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and all we were trying to do is walk in and get served.
Right. So, Alan, you're talking about the involvement, and this is all, again, under the involvement with the socialist students organization, or was it?
Yeah, I can't remember the name of it now. It was student Student Socialist Organizing Committee, or, you know, it was just, it was real small. You know, it was, this is early bird. Right. It's way early.
Wow. So when did you first get in, or first, when did you first start hearing about things that were happening in the Southeast?
Okay. The World War sit-ins were happened right around that time. I can't remember exactly the time because my memory. I got badly injured here in '65, so I have intermittent memory. But I remember joining and helping to organize a sympathy demonstration in front of the Woolworth store in Albuquerque. And I getting hit over the head by a store owner downtown. Lady Arden's was the name of the store, and she was a southerner. And when we were demonstrating, she came up to me with her purse and went, bam, hit me over the head. I didn't hurt me. It was shock. Pretended other things to come.
So by that time, your group had had some contact, or had you been contacted directly, or were you just following the news?
I think we were just following the news at that point.
Okay.
I don't think, no, yeah, I think that's, we were getting the feeds and we were saying, hey man, you know.
Let's do something in solidarity.
Yeah.
Okay. So how did you end up coming all the way from New Mexico?
Okay, I went in 62. I went to the Peace Corps in Venezuela, and then I came back from Venezuela. When I came back from Venezuela in 63, instead of flying home from Caracas, I flew into Washington, D.C., where an old friend of mine was that I had, at that time, a good buddy, who was going to law school. And we talked, and I decided to stay around there because there was a lot of stuff going on, you know. I met Julius Hobson, who was a fantastic man. He was the leader. You know who he is?
Yeah, I've heard about him.
Julius Hobson was one of my first mentors. Great man. Great man of great courage, political and moral courage, and imaginative and intelligent, all the goodies, man. He had them. I was in DuPont Circle after I'd been there for a few months or even less, and I was sitting around talking with some people about the Civil Rights Bill, just sitting on the grass. Cops came up and they just stood there and listened to us, and then after a while they grabbed us and started beating on us, saying, you know, you can't talk about this. And they were white cops, and we were talking about, you know, issues around racism. I mean, primitive as they were. And so I got the shit kicked out of me. I don't know why they centered on me, but they did. And make a long story short, I went to jail. I went to jail several times in D.C. And I joined CORE. Somebody invited me to come to a CORE meeting, and that's where I met Julius Hobson. Ended up becoming the chairman of the Police Brutality Committee and doing a murder investigation in a jail where they just absolutely, you know, beat a black man to death. And and I got to a grand jury and they refused.
Could I take one of these?
And my consciousness got notched up really fast because I started getting surveilled by, I don't know if it was, you know, district, I guess it was feds. It was the first federal surveillance I ever experienced. And it was because I was investigating this murder of a cop. And there were like seven cops involved, and they couldn't handle the political fallout from it. And that's what the district attorney's office told me. Said, you know, they called me privately and said, Alan, you got a great case here. You've done an excellent job, and you proved your point, but they're not going to indict. And I said, why? And they said, because there's just too many cops involved. They can't handle it politically. And that was I was pissed, man. I was pissed. I'm still pissed. Anyway, it was an elderly black man who was a painter, you know, and they were just doing therapy on him, and they overdid it, and they murdered him in his jail cell.
In the jail.
Yeah, in the cell, yeah. and he didn't do anything wrong. I mean, he wasn't drunk, he wasn't anything. They just saw him, and you know, and they said, you know, I don't know. I don't understand how that fucking cracker mentality works. I know I'm white and all, I just can't get it. You know, it's like, how come the Germans, you know, build walls, man, subdivide the motherfucker. I don't want Germany politically anything anymore. Anyway, so Bob Moses came up, and it was the first time I met him, Bob Paris. And I met him through CORE and helped him with doing hearings, civil rights hearings in Washington, D.C. And I got to know him, and during that work, he said, Cooper, he said, go south, go on down to SNCC, go down to the SNCC office in Atlanta, 8 1/2 Hunter Street in Atlanta, Georgia, and tell him I sent you. So I did. I hitchhiked down to the White South. Fuck. And I went there, and I, you know, walked in and said, I'm Alan Cooper. Bob Moses sent me from D.C. and say, when they just put me to work. And so I started working SNCC office, and that was when, let's see, JFK was murdered while I was working the SNCC office.
63.
Yeah. And then there was this peace walk that came through. I don't know if you ever heard about CNVA, Committee for Nonviolent Action. Quebec, Washington, Guantanamo Walk for Peace, it was called. And it was an integrated walk for peace with Cuba. So I joined it and went through Southwest Georgia and into Florida and Northern Florida, and we got jailed and the shit kicked out of us and fingers broken. And
how many people were on the march?
There was probably about 25, 30 people. And we literally walked. I mean, we literally walked all the way, and we'd set up, you know, a place to stay the next night. And it was organized by Quakers, and it was but it was a militant group of people, including a lot of local people, including African Americans from Georgia, and I made some really solid friends there. And one of them actually was murdered later by the cops. It's hard to talk about this stuff, you know? I'm sorry. That's how I stay healthy. And so I was with that group, and then went to jail in Florida and in Georgia. And,
where were you in Florida?
Well, we went through, we went down the east coast of Florida, whatever that highway is, down to Miami, and then there was this long hiatus where they were trying to get permission to go across in a boat, and the court challenge was called United States of America versus versus Peace and Freedom. That was the name of it. I thought it was kind of good. Anyway, so... And I ended up, I'm shortcutting a lot of stuff, but I ended up in Mississippi because I was, I asked SNCC, I said, you know, where do they need help? So I went to Indianola. I was sent to Indianola, and I showed up and started going to work here. I was getting $40 a month from a support group in Albuquerque. And I went to work with COFO, Council of Federal Organizations, in I think it was late 64. Now the dates are a little shaky, okay? And I lived with the Tubbs, their children are here. It's very emotional, it's a really neat people. And that, I worked here for until I got hurt. I got hurt pretty bad. So.
When you first came here to Indianola, what kind of activities were you doing?
Knocking on doors. I teamed up right away with Otis, and Otis and I started trucking together, and we did a lot of wild ass work. I mean, talking to people and dodging cops and dodging the Klan and stuff. But I learned a lot here. I learned, found a community of really courageous people. People that stand out in my mind were the Mr. and Mrs. Tubbs, Ollie Bowie. Ollie Bowie was fantastic. I just loved her. I just loved her. And a whole lot of other people that, you know, that supported us and took care of us, looked out for us, fed us, let us sleep in their homes, which put them in danger of their lives. Just white people living in their homes. And one of the more dramatic moments for me was two that stand out big time. Well, there's more than two, but it's when Otis and I got ambushed in Indianola, I think, in Inverness. I told you about that, yeah. Because it affected my health for the rest of the days permanently. I don't mean negatively, but I mean it altered my ability to remember things and stuff like that. I got a fractured skull and I lost the function of my kidney.
So that was when you were trying to do voter registration?
Yeah, we were doing voter registration. I was doing a lot of fundraising. I was getting money into the project, and the Klan found out about who was bringing the money into the project. At least that's what I was told, and I don't even remember who actually told me that. But I was bringing the resources and cars and books. I was an EMT. I am an EMT, so I started kind of a little clinic. Because kids had come out off the plantations, and the slightest little scratch would become a giant ulcerated bleeding, pus-filled sore. And all I was doing was cleaning them and bandaging them, to end the infection. Used a lot of cotton, a lot of alcohol, and 4x4s and 2x2 bandages. That's all I was doing. They tried to get me for practicing medicine without a license. But we did that. We did everything, man. We tried to, literacy classes, door-to-door knock, just organizing for voter registration. There was in 1965, there was a 99-year-old grandmother that lived in Inverness. Her name was Grandma Iser, I-S-E-R. And Otis and I took on Inverness. We decided we were going to bust Inverness. We were going to get the people over there to come down and register to vote, or try to. And nobody would go. Not one. We could get one. And it was a small community, but still, couldn't get anybody to go. And we kept meeting with Grandma Iser. We'd check in with her every day and pay our respects. And she'd ask us questions. And she was 99 years old. She was born the year after Abraham Lincoln was shot. And one day when we drove up and knocked on her porch, and she's sitting right there, but she's still knocking, treated her, with a great deal of respect. And I have huge respect. She was just like, Encyclopedia Britannica sitting there. And she said, "Mr. Cooper, Mr. Brown, I'm ready to go down and register to vote." The hotel. The hotel came with her. And they all knew they couldn't register, but that they were going to try. They did. It was really powerful. And maybe it doesn't sound like much now, but boy, whew.
No, it is. It was
fucking breathtaking, man. It was so powerful. And it was it's such an honor to have, been able to be around these people. They're so fucking courageous. They don't even have any idea how courageous they are. Or maybe they do. I don't know. They're just so unassuming. Such teachers, man. That's what I did. I didn't do anything. I just came down here when I went to college. That's what I did. Anyway, I stayed until that meeting, and I lost my nerve after that. And I was pissing blood, and so the Medical Committee for Human Rights took over my case, and I was up in D.C. for a while, and then my bleeding stopped, but I was emotionally in pretty bad shape, so I ended up going back to Albuquerque eventually, and then I went out to the West Coast and started organizing again, the Black Panther Party in 66. From 66 to probably 75, 66 to 73, I was, by the way, I learned about the My Lai massacre in Mississippi. As I was reading these left-wing newspapers, they would ship bundles of them down to us. The Guardian.
Okay.
Guardian was a great paper, man.
Out of London? Is that there?
No. This is the Guardian, the Marxist paper out of New York.
Okay, yeah.
Damn good paper, man. And I started reading about these massacres in Southeast Asia. And I said, where the hell is Southeast Asia? I didn't know where. But I learned about what was going on in Vietnam while I was in Indianola. Yep. And when I had to leave here, I left in pretty unceremoniously because I was hurting and I was scared and I lost my nerve. When you lose your nerve, man, you can't be effective. You got to be able to, you know, you just get it on. You just get out there and you do the work you got to do. You try to be careful, but you can't just cower in a fucking corner. And I wasn't going to stay around if I couldn't get, you know, do it. Oh, another thing that I'm kind of proud of is when the Black Power movement came into, swept into Mississippi, I was the only white that they voted to keep. The county Sunflower County Improvement Association took a vote, and I was voted to keep it. Let's see, it was 22-1, 22-4, and one abstention.
So they voted individually on white members. Okay. Yeah, I'd seen something. Robert Moses was up at a SNCC reunion up in Raleigh, North Carolina, a couple months ago.
A SNCC reunion?
Yeah, they had.
Well, God damn it!
But it wasn't very well publicized because the group that was doing it was very small, and it was kind of focused on North Carolina, and it was focused on Ella Baker. People were trying to kind of come together and kind of honor her for the role she played. And,
oh man, and she was like pivotal.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wish, I'm afraid though that the publicity probably, I wasn't involved in the publicity or anything, but I'm afraid that it might not have gotten out past like the Southeast or the Northeast, because it seemed.
I mean, I didn't even hear about the Jackson reunion until after it happened, or until it was like happening.
Yeah.
Shit, if I'd known about it, I would have come down, you know?
Yeah, a lot of these are locally organized by people and they just don't have resources or whatever. But, but I remember seeing an interview with him or reading an interview where he, during Freedom Summer, he was asked to give a talk, and he had mentioned during his talk, he brought up the Vietnam War, and he said something like, how in the world is the U.S. going to say it's fighting for democracy in Southeast Asia when it can't even enforce democratic rules in its own?
Oh, yeah. Well, the contradictions were just screaming by that time for me, you know. I mean, I start picking up a gun, you know, here to defend people. And that you had to do it. I mean, you didn't have to do it, of course, but, you know, it stopped people from hitting on you, you know. It stopped people from getting burned, getting hurt, getting killed. Because people, there was, security was like all over the place at night, you know. All the houses that were vulnerable and the... everything that was vulnerable was being guarded at night.
Who would guard it?
We would. Oh yeah, with whatever we had. We have an old, you know, double barrel shotgun or a 22 or whatever. And the Klan is just, oh man, I don't know what you understand that mentality, but they're just total fucking fear-based chicken shit pigs. And unless they got you outnumbered 10-1 and you got nothing and they got arms or something, they don't want to mess with you. You shoot a windshield out and you won't hear from them for months. You know, because their courage is a bully courage.
Yeah.
It's a fear-based courage, and they don't function well with that.
So people here locally had that idea though of self-defense.
Oh yeah. It didn't start out, but boy, damn sure got there pretty quick. You know, I can tell you a lot of little, you know, in vignette stories, but you don't want to hear those.
Oh yeah.
Just a lot of stuff. Otis and I, when we were trying to crack Inverness, we went over there and people wouldn't put us up. We said, okay, well, we're just going to sleep on the side of the road here, right in the middle of the community. Oh, man, that just drove them nuts. That lasted one night. And we were tightening the screws, you know. We had to get them to break out of their fear. And it's kind of outrageous in a way, you know, saying, hey, motherfucker, open your doors and let us in. We didn't do that, but I mean, we were saying that in effect because we knew that they had to step forward. We couldn't carry them. They had to carry themselves, and they had to break through that fear, and they did. after that first night. But boy, I'll tell you, man, we almost died that first night. We were hiding in a field that was, as I recall, and it may not be, I may be garnishing the story, but as I recall, it was an open sewer. And we were laying in that open sewer with our faces, you know, there were rows, they were like 3 feet in a row, and then 3 feet in a row, and it was the water, it was before they had regular sewage, and we were laying in the sewage, and the people were driving all around Inverness looking for us, but they didn't come out in the field because it was full of shit, and they would do searchlights across, but the hedgerow, or not the hedgerows, but the banks, the light, they couldn't see us because we were lying flat down. And then when they left and went away, we crawled to some tar paper shack, knocked on the back door, and the old man, I'd never seen him before in my life, you know, knocked, and he knew who we were, and he knew what was going on. The whole fucking community knew what was going on because all the lights were out in the black community, you know, and there were probably a lot of guns behind those doors. And he opened the door crack and saw who we were and opened the door, and we crawled in just stinking shit and went to sleep on the floor, slept there that night. And then, of course, everything kind of changed in the daytime, you know. Then there's this air of respectability. Inverness, you should know, that was 65. Inverness, in 1959, lynched a black man in daylight, broad daylight, on the goddamn main street of Indianola, I mean of Inverness. You know, we're talking about, you know, Nazis. We're talking about, I mean, and it's something else you should know. I don't, maybe you already know. I'm sorry, I shouldn't assume that you don't know this. But when they were looking for Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, right, they found the bodies of six black men who had been tortured and killed. By accident, they found them with grappling hooks, just checking swamps, rivers, lakes, streams, whatever. They found bodies, and they didn't do a goddamn thing to look, you know, find out who they were, how they died. No investigation. The only way they investigated was Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, because Schwerner and Goodman were white.
Right.
You already know all that shit.
Well, it's important to get it down, though.
Probably.
I mean, it means a lot more coming out of you than me, because you were the one who experienced it.
Tell you another story, and I don't remember even know the name of this. I used to know the names of the people, and I'm sorry, I don't. My memory banks aren't good anymore. But I remember in Macomb, Mississippi, a whole family disappeared. A whole goddamn family. They had food on the table. They had cars in front. They had neighbors and family, and the whole family was involved in the movement. And the whole goddamn family disappeared, never turned up again. Food was on the stove, Pa. On the goddamn stove, and the whole goddamn family disappeared. Fuck. The whole goddamn family. Right under people's noses. Well, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people died, but there was a lot of people, man. People disappeared. I heard story after story. What happened to so-and-so? Oh, I don't know. Just disappeared. Gone, you know? Couldn't prove anything because they were just gone.
Right. I mean, it makes sense with all that happening that people would start to think about defending themselves.
It would be a crime not to, you know, to defend yourself from attack and your family being attacked. Of course you have a right to do that. I mean, if you're nonviolent and you choose not to, I totally respect that. Nonviolence is the moral superior and all that. I agree. I don't think it's a morally superior position to have a gun. I think it's a morally inferior position. It's a sign of weakness. But goddamn it, when it gets down to the goddamn nitty gritty, man, you know, it's different. You know, it's nice to talk about lofty ideals, and I've talked about them all my life. But when somebody says, somebody messes with my family, I'll defend them. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's like a conservative position. That's nothing radical about that.
Right.
Not to me. Now, this is, I haven't been here for 36 years, and I've thought about it, and I've prayed, and I went on the Sweat Lodge Road after I went to Wounded Knee in 73, and so that's my kind of my spiritual thing now. I'm sorry, I'm talking too much, aren't I?
Oh, no, actually, I was thinking it's 2 o'clock, we should probably...
Oh, it's starting?
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Alan, for
you bet.
Taking time out.
Make sure I have the correct.